Dear Talking About Platforms listeners, this episode is part of our special AI-generated series, exploring the key ideas and influential works that have shaped platform studies. Let's get started.
Welcome back to the Talking About Platforms podcast. Today we're going to be talking about network effects and platform competition. We've got three classic papers by Katz and Shapiro, as well as one by Rasha and T. Roll that really laid the foundation for this whole field.
Yeah, these papers are must-reads for anyone doing research on platforms. I think they're also really valuable for practitioners and policymakers, you know, people who want to understand how these digital giants operate.
For sure. So let's jump right in with the first paper by Katz and Shapiro. This is their 1985 paper called Network Externalities, Competition, and Compatibility. It was published in the American Economic Review. And it gets to the heart of why platforms are so powerful.
Yeah, it all comes down to this idea of network externalities, where a product or service becomes more valuable the more people use it. The classic example is the telephone. The first telephone in the world wasn't very useful, but as more and more people got telephones, they became incredibly valuable because you could actually call someone.
Right, the value's in the network. And the paper points out that these externalities aren't just limited to communication networks. They pop up all over the place. Especially in tech.
Exactly. Think about video game consoles. The more people buy a certain console, the more likely game developers are to create games for it, which in turn makes the console even more attractive to buyers. It's a self-reinforcing cycle.
Kind of a snowball effect, but for value.
Yeah.
The bigger the network gets, the faster it grows.
Exactly. And Katz and Shapiro go beyond just describing these network effects. They actually use game theory to model how firms compete when these externalities are present.
Game theory. So they're looking at how companies make strategic decisions based on what they think their competitors are going to do.
Exactly. They introduce this concept of a fulfilled expectations corona equilibrium.
Right.
It's where companies make decisions based on what they expect their competitors and consumers to do. It gets pretty complex, but the basic idea is that everyone is trying to anticipate what everyone else is going to do and then make the move that's best for them.
It sounds like a high-stakes game of chess where the board is constantly changing.
It is. And because of those network effects, the market can settle into some pretty interesting equilibrium states. One possibility is a symmetric oligopoly. This is where you have multiple firms with relatively similar market shares. Think about the early days of personal computers, where lots of different brands were competing.
Right before the market consolidated around a few dominant players. So what are some of the other equilibrium states?
Well, you can also have a natural oligopoly, where the network effects themselves act as a barrier to entry. Think of industries with huge upfront investment costs. Only a few companies can really afford to compete. And in a market with strong network effects, those existing players have such a big advantage because of their large networks that it's really hard for new companies to break in.
So the network effects create a kind of moat around those established companies, making it difficult for newcomers to gain any traction.
Exactly. And then there's asymmetric oligopoly. This is where a few firms have very different market shares, like we see in the video game console market today, with a couple of dominant players and some smaller niche competitors.
Okay, so we've got these different competitive landscapes that can emerge in markets with network effects. Now, this 1985 paper also dives into the concept of compatibility and how it impacts network scope, right?
Yeah, compatibility, meaning whether products from different companies can work together, plays a huge role in shaping these markets. If products are compatible, you essentially create a larger combined network, which can benefit everyone. Imagine if every computer had its own unique operating system and software only worked on one specific brand.
Oh, that'd be a nightmare. I think we take compatibility for granted these days.
Yeah.
But it wasn't always a given.
Exactly. Katz and Shapiro use the example of the push for common operating systems in the PC world to illustrate this point. On the flip side, when products are incompatible, like telex versus cable back in the day, those network effects are limited to individual systems.
So compatibility can be a make or break factor for a whole industry. It's not just about convenience. It can determine whether a market thrives or stagnates.
For sure. And the paper makes it clear that decisions about compatibility are rarely straightforward. Companies have to weigh the potential benefits of expanding the overall market against the potential risks of losing their competitive edge.
Right. A company with a dominant market share might not be so keen on making things easier for their rivals.
Exactly. They have a strong incentive to maintain their advantage. Katz and Shapiro point out that firms with large existing networks or strong reputations often resist compatibility, even if it could be better for society as a whole.
It's that classic tension between individual incentives and collective well-being. What about the companies that are trying to break into these markets? Do they have different incentives?
Absolutely. Smaller players or those with weaker reputations often favor compatibility because it helps them level the playing field. It's their way of saying, hey, we can play in this market too.
So compatibility can be a strategic tool for companies trying to gain a foothold or for those trying to solidify their dominance.
Right. The 1985 paper really highlights how these strategic considerations can sometimes lead to outcomes that aren't ideal for consumers or for the overall market.
Okay, so we've got network effects creating these different competitive landscapes, and we've got compatibility acting as this wild card that can either boost or disrupt those landscapes.
Yeah.
What's next on our deep dive agenda?
Well, let's move on to Katz and Shapiro's 1986 paper, Technology Adoption in the Presence of Network Externalities. This one was published in the Journal of Political Economy, and it builds on the foundation of their 1985 paper and takes a closer look at how technologies actually get adopted over time.
So we're moving from a static view of competition to a more dynamic one, where we see how these markets evolve over time.
Exactly. And this paper is all about understanding how those early adoption decisions can have ripple effects that shape the entire market for years to come, especially when network effects are at play.
Yeah, it's like dropping a pebble in a pond and watching the ripples spread out. A few early adopters can set in motion a chain of events that determines which technology ultimately wins out.
So those early decisions have a disproportionate impact on the market's trajectory. That's fascinating. But why is this dynamic process so crucial to understand?
Because it gets to the heart of standardization. Will a single technology become dominant? And if so, will it be the best one? Think about the QWERTY keyboard. It's a classic example of how an early and arguably less efficient design can become locked in as the standard simply because of network effects.
Right. Once enough people start using QWERTY, it becomes the de facto standard. Even if there might be better keyboard layouts out there, it's inertia in action. Exactly. And the 1986 paper explores two scenarios that highlight the complexities of standardization. The first scenario is what they call new property rights. In this scenario, anyone can freely copy a technology. Think about the early days of the internet, where a lot of innovation was happening in open source communities.
So it's like a free-for-all where everyone can build upon each other's ideas. Sounds great in theory, but what's the downside?
Well, the paper argues that in this scenario, the market might not actually reach standardization. You could end up with a fragmented landscape where lots of slightly different versions of a technology are competing with each other.
Kind of like the early days of the web where different browsers rendered pages in slightly different ways. Mm. It was a bit of a mess.
Exactly. And even if the market does reach standardization, there's a chance that the wrong technology could win out simply because it gained enough early momentum.
So it's not always a meritocracy. The best technology doesn't always win. It's like a popularity contest, where early popularity can lead to long-term dominance.
Right. And that's where the second scenario comes in sponsor technologies. In this scenario, firms have property rights over their innovations, and they can use strategies like pricing and marketing to influence adoption.
So this is more like the tech landscape we see today, where companies like Apple, Google, and Microsoft are fiercely competing to establish their own ecosystems and platforms.
Exactly. They're investing heavily in building those networks and trying to lock in users. And the paper shows that while sponsored technologies can lead to faster standardization, they also raise concerns about market manipulation.
Right. If a company has enough power, they could potentially steer the market towards their own technology, even if it's not the best option for consumers in the long run.
That's the worry. They might overpromote their technology to create a large, locked-in user base. Even if that technology isn't necessarily the best in the long run, they're prioritizing building a loyal following over letting the best tech win out naturally.
So it's a trade-off between the potential for faster standardization and the risk of reduced competition and innovation.
Exactly. And that's a trade-off that policymakers are grappling with today as they try to figure out how to regulate these powerful platform companies.
Okay, so we've seen how network effects can lead to inefficient outcomes in the absence of property rights. Mm-hmm. And we've seen how property rights, while potentially enabling faster standardization, can also create opportunities for market manipulation. What's the third paper on our list?
The third paper shifts gears a bit and takes us into the world of two-sided markets. It's Roche and Tyrrell's 2003 paper, Platform Competition in Two-Sided Markets, published in the Journal of the European Economic Association.
Two-sided markets. Those are everywhere these days. It's basically any platform that acts as an intermediary. connecting two distinct groups of users who benefit from interacting with each other.
Exactly. Think about video game consoles, which connect gamers and game developers, or credit cards, which connect cardholders and merchants, or even something like a dating app, which connects, well, you know.
Right. The point is that these platforms need to attract both sides of the market to be successful. They can't have riders without drivers, or buyers without sellers, or daters without, well, you know.
Exactly. And Rachet Tyrrell's paper focuses on how these platforms compete, particularly on how they decide to price their services to each group.
Pricing is always a tricky issue, but it seems especially complex in these two-sided markets, where you've got two different sets of customers with potentially different needs and sensitivities.
Right. And the key insight here is that attracting one side of the market often depends on the size and composition of the other side. For example, a video game console is more appealing to gamers if there are lots of great games available, and it's more appealing to game developers if there are lots of gamers who might buy their games.
So you have this kind of feedback loop where the success of one side depends on the success of the other.
Exactly. And that's what makes pricing so challenging. Platforms have to figure out how to attract both sides of the market, even if that means subsidizing one side to make it more attractive to the other.
Ah, so they're playing the long game. They might be willing to take a loss on one side of the market if it helps them build a larger, more valuable network in the long run.
Exactly. And they have a few different tools at their disposal. Sometimes it's about offering lower prices to the group that's more sensitive to price. Other times it's about attracting a few key players on one side, what the paper calls marquee buyers, who can then attract a larger group on the other side.
It's like getting a celebrity endorsement. If a famous actor is using a particular dating app, that might make it more appealing to other users.
Precisely.
Uh-huh.
And Rocher and Tyrrell also explore how factors like switching costs, the ability to charge fixed fees versus usage-based pricing, and the governance structure of the platform can influence pricing decisions.
There's a lot to unpack here. It seems like pricing in two-sided markets is more of an art than a science. It's about finding the right balance to attract both sides of the market and create a sustainable ecosystem.
Exactly. Now let's shift gears a bit and see how these insights from the papers can help us understand how platforms choose their business models in the real world.
Sounds good. I'm ready to apply some of this theory to practice.
Let's start with this idea of marquee buyers, which we touched on earlier. Rachet and Tyrrell argue that attracting certain buyers, who generate a lot of value on the seller side, can really tip the scales in a platform's favor.
Right, like having a celebrity endorse a product. Or a star athlete sign an exclusive deal with a sportswear brand. Those high-profile buyers can make a platform much more attractive to sellers.
Exactly. Those marquee buyers increase demand on the seller side, which allows the platform to charge higher prices to those sellers.
And that, in turn, can lead to lower prices on the buyer side, creating a kind of virtuous cycle. The more marquee buyers you have, the more attractive the platform becomes to both sides of the market.
Exactly. And the papers don't explicitly talk about marquee sellers, but the same logic applies.
Okay, so if a platform can attract a really popular seller, someone who everyone wants to buy from, that can also create a competitive advantage.
Yes. Rachet and Tyrrell talk about captive buyers, who are essentially stuck with a particular platform for various reasons. These captive buyers can also tilt the price structure. But this time, it's to the benefit of the sellers. Think about a platform that has a monopoly in a particular market.
Ah, so if there's no real alternative, buyers have to use that platform even if they don't love it. And that gives the sellers on that platform more leverage because they know they have a captive audience.
Precisely. The sellers have more bargaining power in that situation, and the platform can extract more value from them by charging higher prices.
It's fascinating how these dynamics can play out so differently, depending on which side of the market has more leverage.
And then there's the issue of multi-homing, which we discussed earlier, where users join multiple platforms. Rachet and Tyrrell find that an increase in multi-homing on the buyer side can actually make it easier for platforms to steer sellers towards exclusive deals.
Wait, explain that one to me. How does multi-homing on one side make steering easier on the other?
Imagine you have two competing video game consoles, and many gamers own both. If one console offers developers a better deal, it becomes less risky for those developers to create exclusive games for that console because they know they're still reaching a large audience, even those who own both consoles. The platform is essentially using the multi-homing buyers as leverage to get a better deal from the sellers.
So it's like the platforms are playing both sides against each other, leveraging multi-homing to their advantage.
That's a great way to put it. And the papers also highlight how compatibility can lead to very different outcomes, depending on how it's achieved.
Right. We talked about how compatibility can expand the overall market, but it's not always a simple win-win.
Exactly. Katz and Shapiro make a distinction between situations where compatibility is achieved through industry standards versus situations where one firm unilaterally makes its product compatible with another's, kind of like creating an adapter.
So with a standard, everyone agrees to play by the same rules.
Yeah.
But with an adapter, one company is taking the initiative, potentially without the other company's consent.
Yes, and that can lead to some interesting strategic behavior. The firm creating the adapter might be doing it to gain market share, but they also bear the cost of compatibility. The other firm might actually benefit from the increased compatibility without having to invest anything.
Ah, so there's a potential free rider problem there. It's like one company is doing all the heavy lifting and the other is just reaping the rewards.
Exactly. And this can discourage companies from investing in compatibility, even if it would benefit the market as a whole. Katz and Shapiro find that these private incentives for compatibility don't always align with what's best for society.
So there's a potential role for policymakers to step in and encourage compatibility, maybe through setting industry standards or providing incentives for firms to cooperate.
Yes, though it's a tricky area. You always have to weigh the potential benefits of compatibility against the risks of stifling innovation.
Right. You don't want to force companies into solutions. That might not be the best in the long run.
Exactly. The key takeaway is that compatibility decisions are complex.
Yeah.
And there's no one-size-fits-all answer.
It really depends on the specific market dynamics and the strategic goals of the firms involved. Now, these papers were written before the rise of the modern internet, but their insights are even more relevant today than ever.
Absolutely. We see these dynamics playing out all around us, from the battles between streaming services to the debates over net neutrality.
These papers provide a framework for understanding how platforms compete, how they create value, and how their decisions can shape entire industries.
And let's not forget the crucial role of expectations. Katz and Shapiro emphasize how consumer expectations about network size can actually become self-fulfilling prophecies.
Oh, right. If people expect a technology to be successful, they're more likely to adopt it, which in turn makes it more successful.
Exactly. Expectations can have a powerful impact on market outcomes, especially when network effects are present. And that's something that all platform builders need to keep in mind.
So it's not just about building a great product. It's also about managing expectations and convincing users that your platform is the one to join.
Precisely. The papers highlight the importance of understanding the psychology of users and how their beliefs about network effects can influence their decisions.
Right. We spent a lot of time unpacking Roche and Tyrrell's 2003 paper, which delves into the intricacies of pricing in these markets. What are some of the key takeaways from that paper that you think are particularly relevant for our listeners?
I think the biggest takeaway is that pricing in two-sided markets is not a one-size-fits-all proposition. Platforms need to carefully consider how their pricing strategies will impact both sides of the market, often making these strategic decisions to subsidize one side in order to attract the other.
Right. It's about playing the long game, being willing to take a loss in the short term to build a larger, more valuable network in the long run.
Exactly. And the paper also highlights how factors like the presence of marquee buyers or captive buyers can shift the balance of power between those two sides of the market, leading to different pricing dynamics.
So there's no magic formula. Platforms need to carefully analyze the specific dynamics of their market and tailor their pricing strategies accordingly.
Exactly. And I think these papers also kind of subtly challenge us to rethink the role of regulation in these markets. Traditional antitrust frameworks, which were designed for physical goods and services, might not be adequately equipped to address the unique challenges posed by platforms.
Right. Network effects can lead to these winner-take-all dynamics, where a single platform becomes dominant, potentially stifling competition and innovation. So we need to develop new tools, new approaches to ensure that these markets remain dynamic and competitive.
I completely agree. And that's why I think these foundational papers are so valuable. They provide this framework for understanding the complexities of platform competition, which is essential for anyone who wants to build research or regulate these powerful entities.
Well said. As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought. These papers were written decades ago, yet their insights remain incredibly relevant today. The challenges and opportunities of the platform economy are only going to become more complex and more important in the years to come. So understanding the fundamentals is more crucial than ever.
I completely agree. These papers provide a really solid foundation for anyone who wants to engage with these issues in a thoughtful and informed way.
That's a great note to end on. Thanks so much for joining us for this deep dive into the world of network effects and platform competition. We hope you found it insightful and informative.
It was my pleasure.
And to all our listeners out there, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep pushing the boundaries of knowledge in this really exciting and rapidly evolving field. We'll see you next time on the Talking About Platforms podcast.
Thank you for listening to Talking About Platforms. In this special series on platform classics, we use AI to review and present published research, with intellectual property remaining with the original authors. Our goal is to make these insights accessible and encourage you to dive deeper into the original works. Stay tuned for more episodes and keep exploring the fascinating world of platforms.